The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 12th of October, 2021, on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Daniel Bage. Coming up on today's program: the UK's government waited too long to impose a lockdown, leading to the worst public health failure ever. This according to a new report. We'll get the latest on the debate over what should have been done in the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic. Meanwhile, in Thailand, the country's prime minister has announced the country will reopen to fully vaccinated tourists from low-risk countries. And a bit later, we're off to Latin America.
I'm Monocle's Latin America affairs correspondent, Lucinda Elliott. And today I'll be casting an eye over the River Plate from Uruguay to Argentina, where a court has dismissed yet another criminal case against Vice President and former President Cristina Kirchner.
Thanks, Lucinda. Also ahead, we'll hear of a song that has become an alternate national anthem in Mexico.
If you play that song, actually people will just get crazy and scream, and actually just because everybody knows the lyrics of this song. It was fantastic. It's a lovely song.
All that right here on The Briefing with me, Daniel Bage. A major new report here in the United Kingdom by a cross-party group of MPs has slammed the government's early response to the COVID-19 pandemic. The report finds that thousands of care home deaths could have been easily avoided and says delaying a lockdown in early 2020 ranks as one of the most important public health failures in UK history. Well, for more on this, I'm joined by Lance Price, former director of communications at No. 10 Downing Street under Tony Blair. Lance, good afternoon. Good to speak to you. We've sort of been focused on the reopening and the government's decisions around ending restrictions in the last couple of weeks, months, but there are some MPs who haven't forgotten about the early days of the pandemic. What are some of the most damning findings in this report?
I think perhaps the most damaging is the reluctance of the government taking advice from their scientific advisors to lock down the country as quickly as they could have done, not just once, but twice. So in the early days of the pandemic, when people were still trying to work out exactly how it was spread and what the risks were to the population, Britain was slow. There was a sense of groupthink and fatalism that perhaps there was nothing much you could do, whereas internationally, other countries who had better experience of dealing with pandemics of this kind, coronaviruses of this kind, were acting much more quickly. So there was a problem there. There was a second problem in September of last year, with the second lockdown, which undoubtedly was delayed by several weeks because of the government's reluctance, ministerial reluctance, to put the country through another lockdown again, because they felt that the public weren't prepared to go along with that. So there were very, very serious issues. But the most damning criticism contained in this report from MPs to select committees is the delay in imposing the kind of lockdown that could have slowed the spread of the virus and saved probably tens of thousands of lives.
We all saw the comments apparently from Boris Johnson all across the tabloids about, you know, let the bodies pile high and we'll get through this, and in their sort of approach in trying to get to herd immunity. What is the reasoning that's been found on why they delayed so long?
essentially that they didn't know whether or not a lockdown would work, I suppose, and that they weren't prepared to consider such drastic action. So there's a tendency, I'm afraid, in British politics to hope for the best a lot of the time and to take things slowly and to try things step by step rather than going in and taking very, very decisive action quickly. And I think although the report doesn't make political judgments in the sense that it doesn't look at whether or not Boris Johnson is the kind of man who makes a decision quickly, those factors actually are very important. And I think as people come to analyse this report, and even and more significantly, when they come to look at the evidence that's put forward to the full public inquiry, which won't start until next year, those sorts of questions will be crucial. You know, was Boris Johnson the man for the moment? Was he capable of making the kind of decisions he needed? And was he capable of actually putting his scientific advisers, rather than just going with whatever they said, but putting them on the spot and saying, what are the consequences of the advice that you're giving me? Are there alternatives? How are other countries responding to this? And therefore, you know, how do I make the best decision in the best interest of this country? It was clear that that process wasn't followed, and that had it been followed and had we had a more decisive government with better advice, that certainly many, many, many thousands of lives could have been saved.
You mentioned a public inquiry that is forthcoming. Could there be repercussions for the Prime Minister or his ministers, the main characters throughout this pandemic? Of course, Dominic Cummings, former Health Secretary Matt Hancock, who obviously gave evidence. So what's going to happen to them?
Yeah, I mean, there definitely will be repercussions. The question really is how the public responds to all of this, because the reports that we've seen this morning are balanced in the sense that, yes, some very, very serious mistakes were made. But then they say that later on, this year in particular, that the government's rollout of the vaccine program was extremely impressive. That was world beating. That was ahead of the curve, whereas previously at the beginning of the pandemic, we had been behind the curve. The question that is very hard to answer until we get more of the evidence and this public inquiry that we've been talking about is how the public will view all of that. Will they say, oh, well, nobody could have done better. It was an unprecedented situation. Of course, there was a degree of chaos and ministers faced some very, very difficult decisions. Essentially, the question is, will the voting public cut the government some slack over all of that? Or will they look back and say, actually, you guys failed us?
And what has the response been from the government? Obviously, Health Secretary Sajid Javid has faced a couple of questions this morning. What's been the response? Obviously, the government will be focusing on the reopening and the success of the vaccine rollout, as you just pointed to. But what are they saying?
Yeah, well, as you would expect, the government, as they do with any critical report, and this is a very critical report, they will always pick on the good bits from their point of view, and those are about the vaccine rollout. And they will also try to say, oh, well, this criticism is all very well because it's all done with hindsight, and hindsight's a fine thing. But actually, when you're in the midst of a crisis, you don't have that benefit. You have to make decisions based on the evidence that you have available to you, and they are insisting that they made the best possible decisions they could as quickly as they could. And why wouldn't they? Because they, like everybody else, wanted to protect the British public and stop the virus spreading. So they'll say that in the circumstances that they faced, they made the best possible decisions they could. Now, to a certain extent, they are benefited from the fact that the Prime Minister isn't even in the country at the moment, so he's not facing questions about this, and he will face them next week when Parliament resumes here in the United Kingdom. So relatively junior ministers so far have been put out to defend the government's position, and they know that this is only the early skirmishes in what will be a very, very politically charged argument about what was done and when, but that really won't come properly until we have the full public inquiry.
Lance, thank you for this. That was Lance Price on the line. Now here's Monocle's Paige Reynolds with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Daniel. North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un has accused the United States of stoking tensions on the Korean Peninsula and vowed to build what he called an invincible military. The speech was held at a weapons development exhibition and comes one day after the North Korean leader acknowledged his country faced deep-seated economic challenges. Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi is hosting a virtual G20 summit today to discuss the plight of Afghanistan. The summit is focused on security and how to provide aid to the country amid fears of a growing humanitarian crisis under the Taliban's rule. The UK's Brexit Minister David Frost is demanding changes to the Northern Ireland Protocol, agreed as part of the country's departure from the European Union. It comes following a protracted standoff over the role of the European Court of Justice in overseeing the deal. The European Union in Brussels will be answering with its own proposals tomorrow. And Fosun Fashion Group, the Chinese multinational conglomerate, has announced it will henceforth be known as Lanvin Group, the storied French luxury fashion brand that Fosun acquired in 2018. You can find out more about the corporate rebrand by heading over to monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Daniel.
Thank you, Paige. Thailand is going to reopen fully to vaccinated tourists from low-risk countries at the beginning of next month. The country's prime minister announced the news last night, citing the urgent need to save the country's struggling economy. Before the pandemic, Thailand attracted nearly 40 million visitors each year, with tourism making up 20% of its national income. Well, for more on this, I'm joined on the line by the Bangkok-based journalist Vincent Vichitvedakorn, who writes for the South China Morning Post, Nikkei, and The Guardian, among others. Vincent, good to speak to you. Talk to us about how these rules are changing.
Well, it's interesting to see what the announcement was yesterday, because there isn't a lot of information yet. We know that the country will be reopening across the country on November 1st to approximately 10 countries. We don't know which countries yet. They mentioned a few, the UK, the US, Singapore, Germany, but we don't have the full list yet. And more importantly, we don't have the details on what the conditions are. The Prime Minister said there'd be no quarantine, but we don't exactly know what other conditions will apply.
We mentioned the amount of visitors that normally come to Thailand each year, one of the most touristed places on the planet. Throughout the pandemic, Thailand tried a few different things that really didn't work out to reopen and to open with certain bubbles. But how bad has it been for the country? We mentioned that number of people, but also the GDP income that usually comes from tourism. What's it been like in the past year or so?
It's been devastating. The number of unemployed, and it's hard to track exact numbers because in the tourism industry, in restaurants, hospitality, hotels, so much of the labor force is informal workers. So they're not necessarily documented in the system all the time. But some of the estimates run into the millions of unemployed. And the numbers this year compared to, you mentioned in 2019, the last full year of travel, there were almost 40 million tourists. There was 39.8 million arrivals in Thailand. This year, if we make a million, we'll be lucky. For the calendar year after the lockdown started, there were 28,000 tourists total. So the numbers are so small and so insignificant. One of the plans that people placed a lot of hope in that started a couple of months ago was the Phuket sandbox. So people going to the resort island of Phuket, fully vaccinated tourists who are allowed to stay on the island for 2 weeks initially, and now it's been reduced to 1 week before traveling around Thailand. And at least they weren't quarantined to a hotel room. It was sort of a soft quarantine. And initially, the projections were that there'd be 129,000 tourists arriving in the first 3 months. That number was reduced to 100,000 when they stopped making projections. The actual number was closer to 40, and of which half were returning Thai residents, whether Thai nationals or foreign residents.
You mentioned a lack of some clarity in the announcement. Was that expected? And what sort of criticism is the government getting for its communication and choice of strategy in this?
Well, I think that's a really good point. The government has never been very good at giving long-term plans. The prime minister announced a 120-day plan to reopen Thailand. That date would have been this week. The 120 days would have been up, and of course, Thailand has not reopened yet. And there are a lot of last-minute announcements that people don't expect, especially as they relate to lockdowns and restrictions. Bangkok went through 2 months of closures and most businesses being closed and restrictions being on movement and travel in and out of the province and the area. So those were announced with 24 hours or less notice. And so people are very frustrated. People have been questioning, since the announcement last night, people have been questioning whether Bangkok and Thailand are really prepared for this reopening. Do we have a level of vaccination that would allow that to happen safely? Nationally, I think the figures are now about 35% of the population being double vaccinated, so fully vaccinated. The numbers are obviously higher in tourist areas where they've concentrated the effort. In Phuket, for example, the numbers are above 80%, which experts tend to say is a safer level. But that's definitely not the case across the country. So people are a little confused, and I think that, you know, that's the view from within Thailand. But if you're a traveler coming from outside of Thailand, it's also very confusing if the rules can change and the conditions can change. I mentioned that initially the Phuket Sandbox was a two-week program, and then it was a two-week, 1 week in Phuket and 1 week in one of the other tourist destinations like Krabi or Samui. And then that, 2 weeks ago, at the beginning, on October 1st, became just a seven-day quarantine. Well, not quarantine, a seven-day period that you had to stay in one destination before you could travel, with a PCR test at the beginning and at the end. But again, these announcements are made with so little lead time, somebody who's making that kind of, you know, those kind of travel plans can't put together all the paperwork and the tests and the things that they need to, you know, you can't just hop on a plane and come to Thailand.
Vincent, thank you so much for this. We'll have to check in again. That was Vincent Vishitvanikun in Bangkok. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. A global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Today, we are hearing from Aya Khalil, Global Head of the AI Innovation Center at Novartis. Aya, tell us, first of all, how did you enter the field of AI and why the pharmaceutical industry? It might not at first glance seem the most obvious fit for your skill set.
I just finished my PhD in theoretical physics, and it became clear to me that we were going to need massive supercompute power, advanced analytics, machine learning, and AI to analyze this data at scale so that we can get insights from biology and insights on our health in the same way that physicists have been using these tools to get insights about the nature of our universe and space and time and the many particles that compose sort of how we can construct our theory of the universe. Why couldn't we apply this to biology and healthcare?
Aya Khalil, Global Head of the AI Innovation Center at Novartis. An enduring commitment for more than a quarter of a century. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You're back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. Let's next continue with a roundup of news making headlines in Latin America. And Monocle's Latin America correspondent, Lucinda Elliott, joins us on the line from Montevideo. Good morning to you, Lucinda.
Good morning, Daniel.
Let's start by talking about a huge case dismissed in Argentina related to the bombing of the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires back in 1994. What can you tell us?
Yeah, so a federal court in Argentina has dismissed all charges against Cristina Kirchner for her alleged cover-up of Iran's possible role in the bombing of a Jewish community center in Buenos Aires back in the 1990s. And this controversial case against the current vice president and former president Kirchner had been filed by the late prosecutor Alberto Nisman just days before his death. He died from a gunshot wound under very suspicious circumstances in 2015, the night actually before he was scheduled to present what he described as explosive evidence against Kirchner, the then president. And so far, no one has ever really claimed responsibility for the deadly bombing, which killed 85 people and was a real shock to the region at the time that rarely sees this sort of terrorist attack. Israel has long accused Tehran of sponsoring it, a position that Nisman himself supported. But it's one of several criminal cases that have been dropped this year that involve Cristina. And while this decision by the court last week could be reviewed, it really follows a pattern of Argentina's judiciary showing leniency towards politicians when they are in power and sort of heightened scrutiny when they leave office. And this is really where the press in Argentina are shining a light this week.
Well, that is very interesting, and the timing as well, because staying in Argentina, the country's gearing up for some midterm elections. Will those matter? And what do you think the impact of these court cases could be?
Yeah, so this election could be, it's likely to be a serious test of the ruling party's ability to govern over the next 2 years. At the moment in Argentina, the left-leaning coalition holds a majority in the Senate, but all signs point to them losing important allies on November 14. They could also risk falling short of seats in the lower house. At the moment, they do hold the largest minority position. And given the economic outlook for Argentina, this is no good at all. You know, any decisions with the IMF or future policy making decisions are going to be very tough if they don't hold a majority. Argentina is recording over 50% annual inflation. It's suffering from all sorts of financial headaches from the pandemic, issues that also predate the arrival of COVID. So in a way, there could be some serious political instability ahead of the next presidential election in 2023.
Lucinda, let's turn now to look at the COVID-19 situation across South America. Obviously, there have been some questions about COVAX and the failure to deliver vaccines to a number of countries, while others, such as Chile and Uruguay, where you are doing a little bit better. How are things there now? And obviously, there is big news that some of the countries might be removed from the UK's red list.
Yeah, so as of yesterday, all of south of South America, including Uruguay, where I am, was removed from the UK's treacherous red travel list. And, you know, cases here have really come down from a serious peak. Vaccination rates do fare better than many other world regions. You know, Brazil at the moment has a greater percentage of its population with two jabs than the United States. Chile and Uruguay have some of the highest inoculation rates anywhere in the world, well over 80%. With two doses. Argentina does fall short. They're primarily rolling out Russia's Sputnik jab. Most people over the age of 40 have been covered, so that's roughly 50% of adults as of last week. But in the case of Argentina, I'd say, you know, we've still got cases of Delta variant here in the region. Cities like Buenos Aires have fairly high levels of infection when compared to neighboring capitals. And all this when much of the borders in South America are opening to much of the world as of November 1st. But I'd say more broadly, the COVID situation here fares much, much better than, as I say, than other regions.
Well, here's hoping we can do this in studio then soon, Lucinda, if you're able to get on a plane to the UK. Lastly, let's just talk about the COVID vaccines, the first ones reaching Antarctica.
Yeah, so the Falklands sent a batch of jabs to protect the 23 people who work at the British Research Centre in Antarctica. It's taken several months to transport them, given the polar winter, but it does just demonstrate how far these coronavirus vaccines are travelling. The Falkland Islands received all of their jabs from the UK earlier this year, and they have understandably one of the highest vaccination rates in this part of the world, given they have a population of barely 3,000 people. But in fact, the archipelago was exempt from the red list should anyone have wanted to brave the southern hemisphere winter in recent months to make the trip. But yeah, it's good news all round from north to south.
Indeed. Thank you so much for this, Lucinda. That is Monocle's Latin America affairs correspondent, Lucinda Elliott. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
The Monocle Media Summit is back. Join our editors for a look at the brands, correspondents, and titles that are shaping the media landscape and steering its future. This year, the event will also mark Monocle 24's 10th birthday, so we're putting a special focus on broadcast media. A packed afternoon of panels will once again be hosted by Monocle's founder Tyler Brulé and editor-in-chief Andrew Tuck, along with colleagues from print and radio. The session will feature insights from a stellar lineup of industry leaders, like CNN chief international correspondent Clarissa Ward, Bild-Zeitung's deputy editor and chief international reporter Paul Ronsheimer, Zeit Magazin's Christoph Ament, author and researcher Jess Henderson, Finnish TV anchor Matti Ronka, and his BBC TV and radio counterpart Michel Hussein. Plus, there's a chance to watch a special live broadcast of the Monocle Daily on location. And after that, you can meet and talk shop with the speakers and the Monocle crew over drinks. The Monocle Media Summit is taking place on Thursday, the 14th of October, at the Hyatt Regency London, the Churchill Hotel, W1. As a Monocle listener, you can get 10% off your ticket. Head to monocle.com now and enter the promo code M24BIRTHDAY. We look forward to seeing you there.
You're back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. I'm Daniel Bage. Well, as you heard there, we are celebrating 10 years of Monocle 24. And all week, we're playing some highlights from the past decade. And next, we're going to hear an installment that takes us back to the 2016 FIFA World Cup. During the tournament, we took a look at each participating country through the prism of alternative national anthems, the songs that capture the spirit of a country. Well, in this clip, we head to Mexico to learn about a Mexican folk song that became a staple of American rock and roll in the 1950s. The director of the Mexican Tourist Board, Manuel Diaz Cebrian, tells us more.
La Bamba is actually a very joyful song. It comes probably from bamboleo, which is to shake. So it's La Bamba. Actually, just the name evocates, I guess, the rhythm for you. It's a song from the state of Veracruz, which is so close to Cuba. And it has all these roots in Mexican, African, and obviously Spanish rhythms. And it's one of the most famous Mexican songs. Some people believe it's not Mexican because it's been popular and performed by many American and British singers, and especially Los Lobos, this important group that actually died in a horrendous crash. But yes, obviously due to that, it's been widely popular. Know exactly. I mean, much about the history is so it was just created as in the state of Veracruz, as I told you. Yes, Veracruz is a coast, very warm and lovely town. The people of Veracruz had the reputation to be a happy people all the time. So this song is about just putting you in a good mood. It was created originally to be only like folkloric dance, and from that jump into a different level. It's in a way, it could be translated, but it's not really social, but it's actually, it's about talking about people from the coast. It's a sailor and a captain. So it's about, I guess it's about conquering someone and telling this someone that is his range is better than the one she believes she is. And the lyrics are very interesting. It's like to go to the sky, I just need two stairs, one big and one small. It's kind of symbolic. It's kind of a song that in a way flirts in order to attract you. That used to be a song performing weddings, but since the music and the lyrics became popular since in the 50s, because it became like a kind of a rock and roll song, it's a song that actually became a song that you dance and actually change your spirit. And obviously, as for any Mexicans, when you listen to La Bamba, immediately you do this. Porque es arriba y arriba y arriba. Yo no soy malo, es fantástico, es a lovely song. It's a song appropriate for the summer. It's obviously a song which is a joyful song. It's a song that actually comes from the coastline. And obviously because it's a song once you listen to, you feel pride and you feel great, because it's a song that has transcended frontiers and evocates and means it. If you play that song, actually people will just get crazy and scream, and actually just because everybody knows the lyrics of this song. There are so many other songs, as La Cucaracha, for example. But I think La Bamba is more like a funny, it's more like an appropriate for this occasion, for the World Cup. I love it. And Mexico is a very musical country, more than a dancing country. We love singing. So I say, well, La Bamba is great.
That was the director of Mexican Tourist Board, Manuel Diaz-Cebrian. That was one of the highlights from the past 10 years of Monocle 24, which we will be celebrating at this week's star-studded media summit here in central London. If you'd like to join us, do head to monocle.com, where you can find all the details and buy your tickets. And that's it for this edition of The Briefing, produced today by Marcus Hippie. Our researcher was Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, and our studio manager was Krissa Blackwa. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. That's 1300 in Zurich, midday here in London, 7 a.m. in Toronto. I'm Daniel Bache. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.